TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Evolution of Organic. A new film on the history of organic agriculture, told by those who built the movement. After World War II, industrial chemical agriculture almost erased the memory of farming and gardening as practiced for millennia. Even before the 1960s, Back to the Land movement put out a flamboyant reminder for safe food free from oil-based fertilizers and insecticides, individual unknown farmers and organizations preserved the ancient heritage. Director and writer Mark Kitchell, best known for his movies Berkeley in the 60s and his environmental film A Fierce Green Fire, decided to document the many sources for the evolution of organic. I met Kitchell at a community screening at The Grange in Willits, California. He gave me permission to use clips of The Evolution of Organic for this radio program, as the film is going into distribution in early 2018. Here now are excerpts from the film Evolution of Organic by Mark Kitchell. The narrator is Francis McDormand. The first voices are Warren Weber, who owns Starrout Farm in Bolinas, and amigo Bob Cantisano, best known as founder of the EcoFarm Conference.
In the years following World War II, a vast change came over agriculture. And nowhere more so than in California, the state became the vanguard of agribusiness. The use of chemical pesticides and herbicides sterilized the soil and eliminated insects. Synthetic fertilizers made plants grow bigger, faster. Industrial agriculture produced enormous quantities of cheap food. But it's no accident that California also gives birth to its opposite, organic agriculture. Going back to the land was part of the counterculture of the 60s. Most of the hippies had no experience with farming, but they knew they were seeking an alternative, a better way to grow and eat food. They gave birth to an organic agriculture movement.
We had a lot of people who were striking out on their own in a new way, and that made it really exciting. I mean, what was really fun about it was that incredible sense of, hey, we can discover this. What is this thing? Let's do this.
We were communal, and, you know, we lived together. And at the beginning of this, we really had no idea where this was headed. There certainly wasn't anything we were going to call, oh, it's going to be an industry year. No, it felt good to do the right thing. We were going to grow good food. We were going to feed our friends and our families. And we were going to do the best thing we could for the environment.
We knew about organic practices. I've been reading Rodale forever, and we knew about the Soils Association from Britain and Lady Balfour and the whole start of the organic movement, so we were aware of it.
Well, the knowledge was in the books and in the old people. You know, the agriculture had already shifted to a much more intensive chemical approach.
The seminal book was Silent Spring, Rachel Carson. Her expose of the damages being done by chemicals in agriculture, that was the seminal thing for us. So we thought, well, we got to figure out how to grow without those chemicals.
When we rushed into this modern era of ignoring the basics of soil biology and organic matter and substituted that with fertilizers. But it didn't address all the basic soil needs. All it did was address the nutrient needs, and the soil deteriorated as a result.
Today, there is no obedience and reverence of nature whatever in anybody. They couldn't care less about the law of God.
A more metaphysical aspect emerges when Alan Chadwick, eccentric master gardener, appears at UC Santa Cruz just as students are starting a garden. He teaches a generation Rudolf Steiner's biodynamic philosophy.
He was just like radiating energy. And he came to me and he looked me in the eye and he says, "How are you?" And of course, I wasn't very happy with what I was seeing going on in the world. I was actually quite disturbed and looking for something that I could do in my life that would bring health and healing. He got a kind of a crinkle in his eyes, bright blue eyes, and a kind of a under his breath chuckle, and he says, "Well, perhaps you'd like to do something." And I was like, "Yes, this is what I want. I want to be able to work with my hands into the physical world, but also work with my heart and soul." And Alan introduced me to that existence.
Chadwick introduced the ideas of Rudolf Steiner, whose biodynamic philosophy unites spirit and matter, seeing the farm as a whole living organism.
The work that fell to me was to find a way to hold on to that spiritual basis and create that farm that could also be viable in the economic and material world.
So there was a lot of philosophy and a lot of heady stuff, but at the base of it was these really practical things of how to dig a bed and why and what texture and how deep and how to fertilize it and compost it. And that was the real nitty-gritty of what I learned from him. The truth was right there in the garden. Fine food and birds singing, and the reality was really in the moment. Get into a meditative state. Gardening puts you into the present moment.
And you would think that we would glide and smile and just very calmly walk through here and put a lettuce plant. No, we tore the place apart with horses, with, you know, all of our activist heart and mind, our dedication, our fierce Zen practice. We opened the ground and began to plant all kinds of crops, looking at the connection between growing organic food and eating it, enjoying food. So eating is an agricultural act.
Another impetus toward organic is homegrown. Sons and daughters of conventional farmers who reject modern chemical farming.
This movement arose organically, and it happened in many different parts of the country at the same time. There were people beginning to have the same realization that we need to readjust and redesign agriculture. How do we farm and produce abundance and great healthy crops without subjecting the environment to poisons that may have an unintended consequence? How do we farm in a way where we're actually regenerating the soil's capacity to produce while we're producing, while we're making good crops?
I had been born on a walnut farm in Walnut Creek and had seen that agriculture was one of the most important land use activities in the state of California. So I went off to Davis. While I was there, I began to realize that the school, though one of the top ag schools in the world, did not teach anybody how to farm, and that they were curiously uninterested in lots of things I thought they should have been interested in, particularly the issue of social justice in agriculture, environmental and social justice. So we started this research, and that's when we started to find out that they had been developing machines which were really taking jobs away from a willing workforce. And they had been breeding the plants so that the plants could be harvested by these machines and not fall apart. So the famous thing that was developed at Davis was called the square tomato, the hard tomato. You know, the machine could grab the plant and shake off those tomatoes, and they didn't just burst into jelly when they hit the conveyor belt. It was the same time that people coming back from Vietnam had seen the incredible destruction that was happening from herbicide use, and those farmers came back and said, "We're not using those materials anymore. They're not safe." So the farm labor movement, the students back to the land movement, and the Vietnam vets really saying, we're ready to change how we farm. That kind of all came together in the late 1970s, and it's sort of in that soil, really, that the organic farming industry grew up.
Organic is not just farmers. It's about alternative systems of distribution and consumption. Veritable Vegetable starts as a radical collective in the people's food system.
You couldn't even get brown rice in a Safeway. In those days, you had to have a storefront or a co-op or a buying club in order to obtain food without synthetic chemicals and pesticides. And we wanted clean food. And so we had to work in harmony with one another. We had to build community.
The market wasn't very established yet. You got to remember, it was just so nascent. I mean, get stuff in boxes, onto the shelf, that made people start to have a bit more confidence on the consuming end.
We've had farmers literally put cherry tomatoes in a burlap gunny sack and bring them 50 pounds in a bag.
How do you get it to market so it isn't this beautiful chard that ends up at the market completely limp?
What I always tell people about the beginnings was there wasn't really any supply, you know? I mean, on the fruit side especially, We were driving by orchards, seeing if they were abandoned, seeing if there was weeds growing everywhere. If there was, then we go knock on the door and say, do you mind if we pick those abandoned apricots you got growing out there? And then we'd slap on some kind of label, unsprayed plums, and away we went. There was very few conscious organic growers. So many cases we had overripe. We by the time we got them to the stores, you know, the fruit flies were buzzing, and that was almost like a badge of honor. The amazing thing is that this industry grew it all from those points, because why would anybody want to buy this stuff? And in many cases, it was more expensive. So the fact that it grew at all, that's a testament to how dedicated people were to eliminating those chemicals out of their diet.
Sabella Kraus was cooking at the culinary hotbed Chez Panisse when she developed an interest in foraging.
I started meeting these farmers who were growing 8 kinds of heirloom Japanese eggplant and were avid seed savers and deeply involved in being back to the land and not being in the kind of the conventional agricultural scene. And so I had that in one ear. And then in the other ear, I was listening to Alice and other restaurateurs saying, man, there's just not enough flavorful food around. I remember being in France and there were delicious beans. How come these things taste so flat? So I had the good fortune to be there at the time of really putting these two pieces together.
The two biggest pioneers were the Paviches, growing grapes in the South Central Valley, and the Lundbergs, growing rice in the North. Both adopted organic practices before it was a common term.
I graduated from Fresno State. They taught me that chemicals would lead me into nirvana of growing the best table grapes anywhere. That was my premise in the beginning. And it only took about a half a season to realize that it was an utter failure. All we were doing was putting more chemicals on top of a chemically wasted system to begin with. That's when I got down on my knees and prayed. And I was underneath about the third vine in, just like it was yesterday. And I sat there and I said, put my hands up in the air and I said, okay. So if there is a outer force, supreme being, hey, would you please just help me out? Because I really love farming. From the first day that I started farming organic, I mean, microbes were like, boom, like that. And you would turn that soil over and you'd smell that soil and it smelled like the earth. It smelled like the earth was supposed to smell like.
Tonya was a farmer's daughter who married Steve's brother Tom, and they both joined the Pavich family farm.
My family were conventional farmers, so whenever I'd stop by to visit my own family, it's like, what is your brother-in-law doing? And I said, he's going to change the way America eats. And it's a pretty cool thing, and you guys ought to learn about it. He goes, oh, there's a bunch of weeds. It's not, you know, very, you know, it's not precision. It's like, that's not what it's all about. It's all about the soil and making sure there's, you know, beneficial insects. It's a whole life going on there, and conventional farmers could not get it. You know, my dad was from the Navy. If it moved, you sprayed it. If not, you painted it. So I was like, yes, sir.
The Lundberg's father was a Dust Bowl refugee who swore to take better care of the soil. In the 60s, their brown rice became a staple of the counterculture. Around them gathered young growers like Brian Leahy and Alan Garcia.
We called them Lundberg's tailgate seminars because we'd sit on the tailgates of our pickups out in each other's fields. And we would all, someone would have something new and innovative that he'd want to share with the whole group. And so it was that sharing of technology. And then we started having people come from all over the world.
I went to China in 1983, looked out over something that blew my mind, that changed my life. For as far as I could see was this unbelievable vast network of little fields of vegetables surrounded by waterways and pathways, all being worked by parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, children, fields that had been farmed the same way for 4,000 years, but were still fertile and productive. I was trying to understand the deeper roots of the movement that I was a part of. It was humbling because, first of all, I realized once again the tiny fragment that we represented in that broader lineage. It was amazing to discover that here was the root technology of what we were doing. Here were all the techniques were represented. Things that we thought we somehow had discovered, we had only rediscovered. When people say to me, whose shoulders are you really standing on? I have to go way back. This is a long lineage, you know. And it's people who are nameless. It's people who are faceless. It's peasants, okay? This is where we come from. This is why we're doing what we're doing.
By the end of the 70s, there were 60 to 80 organic farms around California. Most were 5 acres or less, tucked into coastal valleys, away from the agricultural mainstream. Santa Cruz was an early center for organic, along with Sonoma and Marin counties. Capay Valley attracted students from UC Davis. Alan Chadwick set up a garden in Covelo. Orchards and vineyards grew in the Sierra Nevada foothills. From Ojai to Oregon, an organic movement took shape.
There was the big default rule, which was do not use synthetically compounded chemicals wherever. So what do we do then? Then we have to figure out how we fertilize. Well, you know you have cover crops. You know you have animal waste. You know you have green waste. So you know you can build the soil, feed the soil, not the plant.
Compost was at the heart of organic technique. Making your own was a rite of passage. Young farmers learned about carbon-nitrogen ratios, inoculating the pile with microbes, heating and turning it again and again until it turned into humus. Life in the soil. Then there's growing your own fertilizer instead of applying chemicals.
We plant almost 80% of our acreage on this home ranch to an overwintering cover crop, and it's a mix of legumes. There's vetch, which is the fine-leafed plant. Mm-hmm. There are peas, which are right here. Mm-hmm. Bell beans, which is a variety of fava bean, and oats. And they all kind of have critical roles in the cover crop mix. The oats provide scaffolding for the other legumes to climb up on. And the other ones all fix nitrogen, which is really critical for our fertility program.
Natural pest control used various techniques. One was beneficial insects. The pioneer of biological controls was Robert Vandenbosch, who discovered in Iran a parasitoid wasp that inseminated aphids and ate their larvae from the inside out.
Robert Vandenbosch released them in our orchard and in other orchards that were not sprayed, and there has been no spraying for walled aphids since the mid-1970s. Completely eliminated the need for spraying, completely eliminated the need for any pesticides for $5,000. What you need to learn to control pests is to understand their full biology. Once you understand its life cycle, then what can I do to enhance its predators, its parasites, its pathogens? And that's a function of understanding biology better, which is getting you closer to nature. And some of it's in the soil, and some of it's above ground, some of it's in the plants, some of it's in the birds.
Biodynamic techniques involve preparations prescribed by Rudolf Steiner. On the fall equinox, manure is put into cow's horns and buried for 6 months.
So that's the horn manure after it comes out of the horn after being in the earth for 6 months.
When we are using those preparations, enabling the earth in a way to begin to heal and balance itself, but it is only the human being that would have the consciousness to bring those materials together in that way and immerse them in the earth in, you know, relation to the cosmic streams, and then bring them back out as a gift towards healing in nature.
But the most basic organic technique is observation.
The art of observation. That when I got into agriculture, that particular skill has proven to be probably the most essential. My farming is real simple. It's based on walks that I take 2 or 3 times a week and lists that I make from those walks. I mean, I don't hear voices, but the plants do tell me what to do. No question about it.
Izzy Martin spent 20 years battling for alternatives to pesticides. She trained farm workers in pesticide safety.
And at one of those labor camps, people came over to us and they said, one of our people was killed. His name was Santiago Quesada. He was passed out in the field, and Santiago had not been drinking. Santiago was an irrigator, which people didn't realize was a way of applying pesticides. You'd put the pesticides into the irrigation system, and in that way, it'd go out across the field. And Santiago had been very cold the night before, and he had taken the bags that had the pesticides had come in, and he had, set them on fire to build a fire to keep himself warm. And he had become terribly, terribly sick and had collapsed. And while he was collapsed in the field, a tractor disced him.
I don't see any possible future where we're not going to move towards reducing pesticide use. The question is how long is it going to take us to do it? How many people are going to have to be poisoned? How expensive is it going to have to get before we decide that it's a priority to put taxpayer money and entrepreneurial money into developing alternatives to pesticides?
All the parts of an organic movement were building through the late 70s and early 80s.
One of the things that happened early in the evolution of organics was its vulnerability to being dismissed as a bunch of children, no efficacy, no scientific basis for it, and that it was vulnerable also to fraud. And the organic community took on verification and certification and developed its own regulatory standards, you know, because we couldn't trust the government to do it.
The local newspaper actually wrote an editorial, said it was a communist conspiracy to overthrow the American food chain to question farm chemistry. University of California said you can't grow food like that, and USDA was hostile.
And what we had going for us in the organic farming movement was taste this tomato. And this will change your world, you know. That pleasure was a far greater motivator than guilt would ever be. And I realized at a certain point that I could beat people over the head with why they should eat organic food and, you know, all the right messages and here's how we're doing it, here's how we shouldn't be doing it. In the end, what I realized was I just needed to learn how to grow the best tomato.
Professional farmers that converted to organic really, really changed the game totally.
Organic really started to take off. Some of the largest farmers in the Monterey area, they got into organic. I remember one of the brothers in his late 70s saying, this is making farming fun again. Because we looked at chemistry and we said, we can do without. And so they started to say, well, we can do with less. And they changed the chemistry, so it's much more benign.
As organic scaled up, it began to divide into an industry and a movement.
As more and more growers from conventional agriculture started becoming interested in organics, they brought along many of the patterns and practices that they had been employing. But the other thing that started to happen is what I've called bifurcation, where some organics became much more like conventional agriculture, and some retained more of its kind of dedication to agroecological technique and more small farms.
We had to disagree with each other. We had to split up. We had to get mad at each other, you know, in order to find our way forward.
We can't have just all little hippie farms. We need the big ones. There's still only about 1% of the land in the United States farmed organically. So, you know, that's just a spit in the ocean, you know, really. So if we're gonna really have major change, we need these large scale conventional farmers to see the light, to succeed, and to push the envelope.
I saw as the 90s came along, this business is gonna be much bigger than I think we realize. And there's gotta be a national distributor that's got tremendous infrastructure that can carry every product they want. And whoever can do that and do it well is gonna be able to take advantage of all this growth. And so that's when I started looking at who can I partner with in the East Coast.
Facing the industrialization of organic, smaller growers moved to the margins. There they found niches and thrived.
I'm actually very excited about the future for organics because I think it's just the tip of the iceberg, not only to grow it from 1% to 80%, to address some of the other fundamental issues like social justice that we've been you know, harping on, and like environmental footprint, reducing that, changing the structures of how food is distributed.
I don't think of it as a movement. I think of it as inevitable.
And then, inevitable, you know, vegetable.
Yeah.
A lot of people say local's fine. I don't need to be organic. I just tell them what I'm doing. And I say, wait a second. This is no. This is a no-no. Because that is taking us back to the 70s when it was a wink and a handshake. I'm sorry. Organic standards mean something.
There are a lot of conventional growers that says, you know, I've taken the best of you guys' organic stuff and have definitely made my conventional stuff way better. There's not a grower that I've worked with that's a conventional grower that isn't using at least 50 to 60% of their program as organic, as opposed to 100% being conventional. That's awesome.
It's one of the great needs of society right now is to put massive resources into understanding how soil works so that we can start to use it, work with it, live with it. I think the great revolution in food production is going to come from that understanding of soil, and it's going to allow us to just change how we do agriculture.
I think organic farming is part of sustainable agriculture, but another part of that is the culture piece of sustainable agriculture, getting the culture of people to start thinking that food is important to everybody and that how we treat the food is symbolic really of how we treat the earth and how we treat ourselves.
And we're not even looking at sustainable farming. I think we're looking more at regenerative farming. How do we regenerate the dream? How do we find another generation? Because we can't sustain what we're doing. Sustainable farming is a contradiction in terms.
It's a different generation, but they have a very similar set of ethics. I'm just jazzed to see the amount of interest now going on with young people. It's phenomenal.
You heard clips from the movie Evolution of Organic by Mark Kitchell. The last voice was amigo Bob Cantisano, organic farmer in several California locations. He started an organic farm supply company, Peaceful Valley, and is best known as founder of the EcoFarm Conference. The film Evolution of Organic is over 80 minutes long and covers up close and personal the complexity and inspiration of the organic efforts and their practitioners and historians. The author, Kim Bancroft, wrote a companion book for the film that will eventually be posted online. She took many of the complete interviews of these farmers, scholars, and activists and edited them into narrative essays. Keep track of the website for the film, evolutionoforganic.com, for screenings and the companion book. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.